And welcome back. The frenetic pace and busy schedules many of us set for ourselves often get in the way of getting things done. We complain that there's just not enough time. Does that really mean the clock is our enemy, or that we are just not very good at managing it? Master Life Coach Jill Farmer, whom you may remember from her days at Channel 2 as an anchor and consumer reporter, has written a book on how to use time more efficiently. It's titled There's Not Enough Time and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. If you have time management issues, give us a call. Jill can probably help. Jill, it's so nice to see you again.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I have to, in terms of full disclosure, let everyone know that we're old friends. We work together at Channel 2. You have held up much better than I have. I'm happy to say for you, but not for me. But
that
it's
not true.
It's great to see you again. Jill, this book is a most interesting one, and I think it really applies to a lot of people. And I also know that it's the result of your own situation, suddenly discovering that there wasn't enough time.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was born out of what I call sort of that rock bottom place that author J.K. Rowling says is a fabulous position to be in to rebuild, or a fabulous foundation to rebuild our lives. And for me, I kept thinking through my working years and my life as a mother that I just needed to change the circumstances or to move through whatever situation I was in, and then I would win this jackpot or windfall of more time is what I call it. And I kept making these shifts, and I still would find myself on sort of one end or the other of the pendulum, either on that hamster on the wheel mode where I was moving for the sake of moving and still didn't seem to be able to get anything done. Or conversely, I was so overwhelmed, I was sort of in a state of paralysis and not really sure where to start. And when I finally did what many considered sort of a drastic step and quit my career, somewhat mid-career, I hadn't, you know, phased out, mm-hmm. or they hadn't phased me out yet anyway.
Which is often the way it works.
Exactly. I found myself in a position where I didn't have a full-time job anymore, and I still seemed to be swinging back and forth from this hamster wheel to that state of paralyzed overwhelm. And it was not a comfortable place to feel. In some ways, I kind of felt like a fraud because I thought, well, here I've made this decision that's supposed to allow me to be and do all these things now and have time to do it, and I still don't seem to be able to get anything done. And that's when I started sort of looking inside and studying and researching why we seem to be preset towards unproductivity and toward that frenzied state if we're not aware of it.
But, you know, it almost sounds like an obsessive compulsive thing, that not everybody would fall into this category, but it might be someone like yourself, if I may say so, who just feels they must keep going.
Yeah, there's certainly a little bit of that, and there's some of it is personality driven. But you'd be really surprised how many people come to me for help, and how many people, when I was speaking to groups about this subject, or who are my individual clients, who sort of cut across demographic, yeah. all kinds of demographic lines, age and gender and occupation, to say, you know, it just feels like I'm supposed to be busy all the time, or what I'm doing doesn't really count, or I'm not worth much. But I've got the busy part down. I just don't have the meaning part down. So I do teach people how to be more efficient and productive. But the really big thing that I want to teach people how to do is how to connect to more meaning in their life so that they feel like what they're doing is not just crossing off lists and achieving tasks, but really lining up with whatever it is they were supposed to be put on this earth to do.
You know, when I first heard about your book, before I actually saw it, I thought the basically, what you're going to be dealing with was either the busy homemaker or the woman who had a career and a home and children. I didn't think it was going to apply to busy executives and other people, but as you indicated, it's across the board.
Yeah, it really has been. And that, you know, originally my message, I think, resonated loudly with people who were in the position that I had been in, which is as both a very busy working mom and as a busy stay-at-home mom. And then as I shared that message with more people, and I spoke at places like Washington University at the medical school, I started having a lot more men coming up to me and saying, you know, we're dealing with this too, and I'm starting to feel like life is passing me by, and I keep buying, you know, the taking the productivity classes and the how to, you know, get more efficient, but I still feel like something's missing. And that's when I knew that some of the lessons that I learned for myself had a broader audience. And there's a lot of new data, thanks to, you know, functional MRI technology and other things that were backing up the reasons why so many people across so many different lines of, you know, age, sex, race, and everything else seem to be falling into the same traps and patterns.
Yeah, there is a neurological component to all of this.
Yes, there is. Yeah. And I'm not a neurologist, and I never played one on TV, but I do find that side of it very fascinating.
Sure. Let's go to the beginning. And it would seem to me, I don't have this problem, by the way, I'm happy to say, but it would seem to me that if you've got this issue with budgeting your time, you make a list, and you devote the first part of your book to some length on list making.
Yeah, I have to say my favorite chapter of the book is actually chapter 9, but my original publisher said, "Oh, wait, you can't just talk about people being addicted to busy. They want to read this book, and if you're going to make it a short read, they have to actually have some tactical things that they can take away from the get-go." And so, yes, the first couple of chapters are about the to-do list. And what I find is a percentage of people in the world are fabulous at using to-do lists and at letting them serve them and at, you know, just using it to kind of help them stay in their lane. And then there's, I would say in my experience, a majority of people whose to-do list serves to abuse them in some way. And that I call it two extremes of that. One is the to-do list overloader who vomits everything that they could possibly ever have to do to be a worthwhile human being onto this diatribe, which they call the to-do list. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other side of people who find that they don't like that black and white proof that they're not enough. So they sort of avoid to-do lists. And then they try to rely on their brains to keep track of stuff, which, of course, our minds don't hold on to information sequentially in longer lists than one or two things and what's immediately in front of us. So it's a pretty unreliable way. And so they find themselves forgetting and bouncing around and kind of dealing with this low-level anxiety all the time of being afraid they're going to forget something and not really doing it.
Yeah. You have the various categories that you established in the beginning, and for definition purposes, I think I should mention them. You mentioned overloaders just a moment ago. What about shoulders and what about freestylers?
Yeah, freestylers are those that are trying to keep the to-do list up in their brain. Yeah. And I use the term, I'm going to use it very carefully on radio, and it's something that anybody who's been through a 12-step program has probably heard about. But a lot of times people use to-do list to should all over themselves, S-H-O-U-L-D. And when we are shoulding all over ourselves, we are constantly sort of hyper-focusing on inadequacy, which isn't a good place to creatively problem solve, and it's not a very good place for us to get stuff done. But if we're not careful, that's kind of our default when we are thinking about productivity and action and doing stuff.
What's the biggest mistake that we make in making ourselves too busy?
Well, I think we are, as a society and a culture and a people, a little bit afraid of not being busy. And so I'd say, you know, sort of the sweeping overreaching issue is that there seems to be a misnomer that the busier you are, the more worthwhile you are. And so we have, in some ways, trained ourselves to be in fight or flight mode because we think that if we're not, then we're not, you know, worthwhile human beings. And the problem is that our bodies and minds were not wired to be in fight or flight mode all the time. They were wired that way so that when in extremely rare cases, hopefully of physical danger, we have that auto, you know, response to get out. And so when we're in that constant state of anxiety and stress, we're really diverting blood away from our brain into our large muscles to help us fight, flight, or flee, instead of really creatively looking at how to experience maximum meaning and maximum time.
Let's define busy. I mean, you can be busy drying the dishes, if you will, or you can be busy, you know, coming up with a new theorem in physics.
Right.
How do you define it?
Well, it's anything that is, different people define it different ways. I mean, the interesting thing that came up for a friend and I as I first started sort of trying to lay out an outline for the book was how many people's sole descriptor of how they are, their well-being as a human, is busy. And so she just kind of as a little, you know, unscientific I guess, experiment, went out and asked the first 10 people she saw, and they were men, women, whoever, how are you today, or how's it going, or how are things? And the response from 10 out of the 10 people was busy. So that's how we have learned to define ourselves. And you're right. You know, you can make that mean I'm busy, you know, out with my scissors cutting my lawn to make sure that the edging is perfect, or I'm busy, you know, finding a cure for cancer. Mm. It doesn't really matter, but we've kind of stepped away from really defining ourselves around anything other than that frenzy.
Are men or women better at managing time?
I can't say. They're different in some ways, although I see some of the same issues from both. My male clients, and when I speak to groups, I will say, as a broad sweeping stereotype, men tend to be a little better at letting themselves be done. So when the last thing on the to-do list is crossed off, hey, I'm finished now. I can go relax and do what I want. And or also only defining the things on their to-do list for things that actually can get done today. Women tend to, even when they'll get things done, then start a whole new one over again until they're, you know, collapsing into bed at very late at night.
We're talking to Jill Farmer, and she is the author of There Is Not Enough Time and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. It's a book teaching us all how to better manage our time. We have a phone call from Jerry in O'Fallon, which I'd like to take before we move on. Jill, let's do that right now. Jerry, go ahead.
Good morning. Shows are always fascinating, but this one especially strikes a chord with me. If I work on a project, I'm working on a couple right now, one's collaborative, I can, you know, when someone puts something in front of me, I can get it done. When it's something I either help to self-start or self-sustain, I have a lot more problems with that. And it's like the old, you've seen the email about, you know, that you put a rock in a jar and then pebbles and then sand. And, you know, the rocks are your big priorities in life, et cetera. And if I find, left to my own devices, I kind of fill time with the sand part, you know, doing the small stuff. And I've had a lot of trouble breaking myself from that habit.
And Jerry, that makes you a human being. and I think I think just a quick key takeaway for you and everybody else who kind of finds themselves in that situation where the self-starting, the projects that require, as you said, self-motivation or for you to light your own fire underneath yourself, is to recognize that when we perceive anything, when our minds perceive anything as onerous or difficult or big, we sort of our natural default is to be averse to it or to move away from it. And so the biggest gift you can give yourself is to take whatever this project is, any project that requires that self-starting in front of you, and to break it down, particularly the first 3 to 5 steps, into ridiculously easy steps. We sometimes get caught up with, well, that isn't enough or it doesn't count. I call it the chunk of time theory. Unless I have 6 hours to devote to this, I can't actually do it. And so then we end up just avoiding and not getting it done. So if you give yourself permission to make that first and second and third step, and then the rest of them too, but particularly those first three, ridiculously easy, you will often find that big project, you know, if you think of it like a giant ball, you're just leaning up against it and getting it to roll so its own momentum takes over a little bit.
You know, you mentioned in your book, Jill, rebooting. Explain that for me, if you would.
Well, you know, most of us are used to that kind of, work ethic that says you rest when you're done. The problem that we've come into thanks to this world of, you know, electronics and working from home and always having access to tasks and things that we should be doing is that there isn't that sort of traditional end of the workday for us. And so most of us, even though theoretically we should have some point where we're done and we're able to stop, we don't reach that. There's no, you know, threshold or there's no marker there. And so a lot of people find themselves physically and emotionally drained and burned out. And so what the new research is showing us is that instead of waiting until you're, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, done, before you deserve to take a break for rest and fun, your brain is going to function a lot better if you pause mid-project, mid-to-do list, and take intentional breaks of rest and fun. And I'm not talking about procrastinating and you know, going on Facebook for 6.5 hours or something that's really not serving you and isn't lighting you up. But it's that intentional something that really brings you great joy or great rest. It's a little like your computer. You know, we've all had that experience where it's running really slowly and we can't get it to go. And we just want somebody to fix it and make it faster. And the answer, whether you're calling in a tech for your home computer or you're calling somebody at your office, they always will start with reboot. Right. Shut down, shut it down. And 90% of the time when we reboot these computers, things reset, the rest a little bit, and it starts running fine again. And so when we use that metaphor for ourselves, it's amazing how much more stuff we can get done.
You mentioned a key term too, and you certainly apply this in your book, and that is take time for fun. Mm-hmm. Fun is important.
It is incredibly important. Our brains learn and grow and are best at possibility harvesting when we engage all parts of it, not just that very analytical, you know, part of it. And so kids are beautiful, you know, kids are fabulous models of this for us at learning and growing and challenging themselves through play. Adults, we're not so good at it.
You also have a number of worksheets in the book. Give us some sense. We can't talk about all of them, obviously, but some sense of what you're doing here.
Well, the worksheets are something that people either love or hate. I happen to not love doing worksheets when I read books, but a lot of people do really find it is a good way to integrate the information and to kind of really apply it to ourselves. So I always say, if you love them, great, and if you don't, that's fine with me. But basically, one of my favorite one of the chapters of the book just forces you to really look at what happens when you believe the thought there's not enough time. What kind of emotions that makes you feel. And when you feel, and when I do this with large groups of people or small groups and workshops and seminars, I hear things like, you know, anxious, frustrated, annoyed, hopeless, a host of feelings which are not so pleasant. And then you take a look in both the worksheet and when I work this with people. How do you act when you're feeling frustrated and stressed out and anxious and annoyed? Well, I don't treat the people around me very well. I don't focus very well. I don't problem solve very well. I hyper-focus on the obstacles. And I make stupid mistakes. Ding, ding, ding. Just that thought creates a cycle that causes an enormous time sabotage. And so I think that's one example of many in the book where you can kind of have a chance to apply that in your own life and see how you can move through it.
That's Jill Farmer, our guest on St. Louis on the Air. The book is There's Not Enough Time and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. It's really a treatise on how to better manage your time. We'll be back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Jill Farmer, the author of There's Not Enough Time and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. It's a discussion about time management. We have a number of calls, Jill. Let's go right to them, and we'll start with Jan on a cell. Jan, I hope you're not driving.
I am, but it comes through my radio, so it's hands-free. I'm quite safe.
Okay, good for you. Go ahead.
Yes. So, Jill, I'm very outnumbered in my home. I'm the only female, and I have 3 males in my home, and they all have an issue with getting started, kind of procrastinating, which I believe kind of falls into this. I love the idea of breaking it down in little pieces, but I'm wondering, does your book address how I, as a person who doesn't seem to experience this, can help to coach those who do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it comes up for a lot of us, particularly with parents, spouses, coworkers. And of course, remember that when we're kind of good at doing this stuff, a lot of times our method for getting other people to do it well is to expect them to do it the same way that we do. And a lot of times as humans, we fall into the habit of thinking that if we just keep trying to do the same thing and convince, especially our kids, you know, lecture them harder, then somehow they'll get it. It doesn't work. And so I would say bring a sort of a spirit of play to figuring out how you can routinize or create habits that are going, because, you know, habits take a lot less effort. Great new book by Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habits, highly recommended to everybody. But habits take a lot less brain power and a lot less effort. So how can you creatively and in a fun way create motivation for the members of the household to create habits so that they're self-starting and not requiring you to be the cue and you to be the reminder and you to be sort of the follow-through on all steps of that. And so it just – and sometimes as a parent, you got to come up with one method for one kid, another method for another one, and yet another one for the spouse. But if you do that in a playful manner, in a way that's creative, I think, A, it makes it a lot more fun for you and those around you, and B, I think it's more likely that meaningful change will happen.
Okay, Jan?
You.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for calling. Let's bring in Leslie calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Leslie. You're on the air.
I was working on a political campaign with two women who I know, Don, you know well, Amy Smucha and Sydney Watson.
Oh, yeah.
Getting terribly frustrated, and Amy said to me, Leslie, don't let perfection be the enemy of the possible.
Love that. Love yeah. that. I was listening to the Diane Rehm show today, and the guest was talking about a saying at Facebook, which is don't let perfect, or, you know, done is better than perfect. My favorite saying related to this was taught to me by a cardiologist friend of mine who says in cardiology, there's a saying that better is the enemy of good, because when people first started doing the cardiac cath procedure, they would get 80% clearance in a blood vessel. And when they went in to do the unblocking procedure, and some doctors would say, well, let's go back and get the other 20%. And in that process, they were finding a pretty high rate of situations where the blood vessel would burst, which was a really
That's
bad
not,
thing.
Not good.
So 80% was plenty good enough. And in that case, better was the enemy of good. So I love that sort of version of something which I think to be really true, and a place where a lot of us get ourselves caught up from an efficiency or productivity perspective. We can spend, research shows, two or three times as much time finishing the last 10 or 15% of a project because that perfectionism will jump in. And that can be pretty exhausting.
I mentioned obsessive compulsive a little earlier, but perfectionist is probably a better term to use for people who mismanage their time.
Yeah, there's a lot of people or who are, I don't want to say mismanage their time, but are the victims of time overwhelm. And perfectionism, and often perfectionism and procrastination go hand in hand, because procrastinators typically believe that in order to do something right or well enough, boy, they really need the proper amount of time. And so they tend to – that never materializes. So they tend to just not start.
You say mismanagement of time is not a word that you would use, but certainly that must come into the equation, that people just don't know how to set up their schedule.
Yeah, I would say, though, people are so good at beating themselves up that a lot of times they'll say, oh, I'm a terrible time manager, I'm bad at this. And instead of really taking a second to say, okay, well, the way I operate best is from this perspective. And when you look at the places in your life where you are doing things extremely well, and you use that as a template for how to better discern and prioritize, and you sort of look inside a little bit to help set your agenda and the why you're doing things, that's where you're going to have your best success.
Back to the phones. This one from Florissant. We'll bring in Peter. Peter, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Jill Farmer.
Well, thanks for taking the call again, Don. Ms. Farmer seems to have hit the nail on the head with this one. Thing of it is, though, I'm retired now, so time isn't a problem. I got plenty of that. Motivation is more of it. It's taken me a while to get started on some projects. Does her book address prioritizing and getting started?
It does, because that I hear that from a lot of people, that, okay, well, now here I am in the situation where I have this vista of time available to me, and I have trouble deciding what to do and how to do it when. And back to what I talked about earlier with Jerry, the first caller, giving yourself a template, and I teach this when I speak to groups, and I teach it in the book too, giving yourself a template for how the project is going to look from a perspective of, you know, tiny little steps. I call them turtle steps. If you think about what a turtle looks like and how little its legs are in proportion to its body, if we take our completion of a project with a version of taking turtle steps, we can, which is a term I learned from Martha Beck, it really does help us to get past that stuck place of doing nothing and into the place where we get to experience accomplishment, which is a great feeling.
382-8255 is our number. We have some lines open if you'd like to talk to Jill Farmer. If you have time management issues, give Jill a call. 382-8255 is the number. Email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Back to the phones now, and Mark calling from St. Louis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Two things. First of all, that find a place to start that you were talking about. You're really right on with that. I had an experience of building a dark room for my wife in the basement of our house, and it was one of those projects that took me forever to get started on because there's a lot of things you need to do, plumbing and electric and dustproofing and all, building walls and all of that. And what got me started is, all right, what do I need to do first? Well, the first thing I got to do is clear out the area, and then I can, so then what do I need to do next? What do I need to do next? And it got done.
Yeah, excellent. I love that. I love that that resonates with you, and I love that you have a practical example of how it worked. And right, most of us start with the first step is, boy, this is going to be hard, and there's a lot of stuff to do. And if we really just start with what needs to be done first, or what would I like to do first, and how can I again, get rolling from that place of allowing it to be even ridiculously easy is a good place to go. So thanks for sharing that, Mark.
Well, you make a distinction between things that you have to do and things that you choose to do.
Yeah, we're so used to being in that, we don't usually write it at the top of our to-do list, but in our mind, it's sort of implicit there. Here's what I have to do today. And it's a little bit of an oversimplification, but when we tell ourselves we have to do something, we do trigger that fight or flight response. Biochemically, we get in that sort of place. And when we recognize that all we really have to do today is breathe, right? We can choose to do a lot of other things that seem pretty important because the consequences of not doing them would stink, but they still are choices. And that's what differentiates us from just animals who walk around reacting to everything to being human beings who have the ability to respond and to make appreciable differences and experience things from a lot wider perspective than just somebody who's or something that's just reacting.
How should we respond to those unexpected things that pop up in the middle of what we're doing and don't have enough time to do anyway, and yet something else comes in to disrupt the whole process?
Well, most of the time, the initial reaction to it is fear, frustration, and resistance. And those are terrible places to creatively problem solve. Yeah. When we sort of begin to do some of the things that I talk about in the book, which is essentially retraining our brain to learn to react differently, then we're able to say, okay, except this isn't how I would have written the script for this. I didn't want the flat tire and they had a way to work. But how can I keep that flat tire from creating this domino effect where I'm just so out of my mind and frustrated and lining up all the evidence for why it's terrible that I then create a series of other things that, by the way, cost me a whole lot more time. Mm-hmm. And the first step is just accepting the reality of what is and then looking for the best way to move through the situation if it's a place that you really don't want to be.
Well, how about dumping problem? When you get to that point where something has to give.
Yeah.
What do you dump? How do you dump? How do you decide?
Well, I think that's where prioritization. You got to be in that good, what I call calm, clear, connected mindset. Because otherwise, when we're freaked out, everything feels as important as everything else. And when we can get to that calm, clear, connected space, even for a second, we're able to look at those priorities more carefully. One of the earlier callers referred to that Stephen Covey sort of way of looking at it. Like when we put the big stones into the container first, then we have room for the sand and the pebbles. And when we put the sand in first, there isn't room for it. It is you have to be able to prioritize what you want to do, and you have to be able to say no.
Back to the phones. We do have a lot of calls for Jill Farmer. Jane in St. Peter's, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just piggybacking on the gentleman who called about retiring. And, I spent so many years pushing myself to meet all kinds of deadlines and not really even saying no to a lot of things that I could have, could have done that. And so now that I'm retired, I find that I'm the opposite of what I used to be. I just don't want to schedule anything. I mean, I will do things. I just don't want to schedule them at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're really right on because we push ourselves to the point where we really don't want to do anything.
Excellent.
Any suggestions?
How is that sort of looser structure around your schedule working out for you? Do you feel better? Are you able to more spontaneously appreciate, love, connections, and beauty in your life? Or are you feeling like...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like I'm 20 years younger and I don't have all the pressure. And I realize most of it was myself trying to meet all these deadlines that I made for myself.
Excellent. So, and that's where, you know, I think that's the wisdom of having experience and recognizing that if we don't learn to connect into that sort of what I, again, will call the three C's, that calm, clear, connected space that you're beginning to see blossom in retirement, then if we can't do that in the years leading up to retirement, we're letting a whole lot of our life pass us by. And, you know, we've got one amazing life to live. How can we experience that those things that you're loving to see unfold in yourself now? How can we experience that, you know, from the time we're young all the way through?
We should point out, too, that people who are retired really should have things to do. I mean, you don't want to be overloaded, but you do want to have an objective for getting up every day.
Right. And you want to have some meaning, too. And I find I have clients that come to me that say, well, they have such deep regret for having put off so much that they really enjoy doing that by the time they get to the point where they have time to enjoy doing it, they've sort of forgotten how to really enjoy it.
Let's bring in Francis calling from St. Louis. Francis, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my issue with time is I think I can do more than I can really do, and then I commit to saying I will do more than I can really do, and it all takes longer, generally, than I think it's going to take.
Excellent. And A, you're way ahead of the game from a lot of people, Francis, because you have learned to recognize this about yourself and beginning to appreciate. And so then, you know, you're two steps into maybe the three or four step process of how to make it better. And that is to I would sit down and consciously write down the evidence from previous experiences of how your a little bit of unrealistic optimism, shall we say, about the amount of time it takes you to do things and the amount of things that you can do has provided you evidence that it doesn't work out so well, so that you can create a trigger or a reminder for yourself. Oh, yeah, I remember that terrible feeling I had when I was not able to fulfill my obligation. Or, oh, gee, I remember how awful it was when I didn't get, you know, any sleep of those nights. So that the next time someone asks you to do something or the next time you're committing to make it to an appointment by underestimating what needs to happen before then, you can take one breath beyond to yourself, and I would say start with doubling or tripling the amount of time that your default, that your instant response. So if you say, okay, well, wait, I can do this later because this is going to take me about a half hour to do. Pause. I'm actually going to block out an hour and a half to do it because my previous experience tells me that I tend to underestimate the time it takes. And give it a try. Play with it. See how it works out.
I think we can take another call now. Anne will join us from St. Louis. Anne, are you there?
Hi, I'm loving everything that you're talking about. I missed the name of your book, but also I wanted to know if you were going to be teaching any classes on writing.
No, I'm not teaching classes on writing, but thank you very much for that. I have a long background in broadcast, so I write like I talk. I think Don can attest that's how we do that.
Without the gestures.
Exactly. And the name of the book is There's Not Enough Time and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves.
Great. Thank you so much.
And do you have time management issues?
Oh, yes. And everything that people have called about not having, I mean, I get a lot accomplished, but it takes me more time than I think it's going to take me. And I had been blaming that on age, but now I'm getting over that. And I realized that perfectionism is a great issue for me. And I need to learn to finish things to completion, no longer just to perfection, and I'm starting to let those things go, and things are a lot happier. And I still get great quality of work done, but I have to just let it go to completion instead of worrying about perfection. So I'm really enjoying this book, and I will the conversation, and I definitely will get a copy of her book.
Well, you just got a two thumbs up from Jill as you were speaking there, Anne, so good luck to you. Thanks so much for calling. In time we have left, Jill, I just want to bring up one of the issues I know is not your favorite method, and that was the use of timers to help schedule yourself.
I love timers when they are just letting yourself break things down into ridiculously easy steps, or to keep yourself from getting sucked into things that are big time sucks in your life. Like for a lot of people, that's email, internet usage, those kinds of things. Some time management programs are based on this draconian, you set the timer for this task and this task and this task, and you only give yourself a break when you have completed, you know, X number of these time tasks. I find those to be a little bit like diets. They work for a while, And then there tends to be a little bit of a boomerang effect of, you know, I'm tired of beating myself and worrying and sort of chaining myself, shackling myself to these. And so I like to look at them as tools, but not something that you should, you know, sort of pin yourself in or jail yourself with.
And very quickly, after going through all of this, have you managed to manage your time better?
Yeah, I experience right now an enormous amount of pleasure, satisfaction, and meaning in my life. And I think I'm better at deciding what I really want to do and what I want to do to make the world a better place. Not perfect at it. My kids are very quick to remind me every time I say I'm really busy or I don't have enough time to remind me of what I really believe.
That's Jill Farmer. The book is There's Not Enough Time and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. Jill, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, I loved
it.
Great
to see you again. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk with the B-52's frontman, Fred Schneider, about his appearance with the Gateway Men's Chorus and with Annie Bloom about her book on the Admiral and other Strek for Steamers. Also, Aaron Williams profiles Blank Space, a no-holes-barred performing arts venue on Cherokee Street. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about water conservation and efforts to improve agriculture practices and water use. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This program is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. Executive producers Robert Peterson. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.